Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. Before I get started, does everybody have a packet? You have packets that should be floating around here if you need more. They look like this. Okay, good morning. Just want to begin with a few words of Hakara Satov. Thank you to Mrs. Kraft for overseeing this amazing learning program, which continues, thank God, to grow from year to year. You look around here, it's really remarkable. Thank you to our incredible office team. We thank Rabbi Frankel, our new executive director. We thank, if you haven't seen them yet, outside, our office manager, Rivki Elkins, and our communications director, Daniela Schwartz, who are kind of moving around. You could introduce yourself to them and thank them. We thank Or Torah for hosting us. We thank our terrific event chairs, all the volunteers, everybody who is involved. And we want to thank the Rabbono Shel Olam for bringing us to this time, Sheikh Yanov Kimanov Yanol Azman Azeh, as we anticipate, many of you have gotten the notice in the mail, we anticipate an exciting transition time now. We have the opportunity, please God, next year to celebrate, if the Mashiach doesn't come before Tisha B'Av, which would be very convenient for me and for a lot of other reasons, to celebrate next year being our 10th year here in Chicago as the merger of the YU and Torah Mitzion Kolim. And so we are excited to look forward to that Habaleinu Latova. So thank you everybody for participating today, and I'm excited to learn together with you on a topic which... it's a difficult topic, it's an exceedingly sensitive topic, but it's a very personal topic to me because it's something that I struggle with. And I venture to guess that some of the people in this room struggle with it, and it's something that maybe our community in general, and all Jewish communities at all times, struggle with this challenge. And when we talk about this, I think it's important to keep in mind that there is the personal, there's the aspect that relates to me as a person, and then there is the general concept, how it relates to, you know, life and the community as a whole. And in any examples that I'm going to share this morning, it has nothing to do, keep in mind, with any person who is here in this room or anybody who you might know. These are all theoretical constructs, and nobody should feel like, wow, I can't believe he's talking about me. I'm actually talking about myself. Although most of the examples that we're going to be reflecting on today have to do with women. As you notice, I'm the only man in this group. But this is a universal challenge. It's a universal issue that we need to think about. And we need to balance this struggle with the confidence that we have in ourselves and in our community. You know, I look around this room, I see so many people who are unquestionably greater tzaddikim and tzidkanios than I'll ever merit. You have such amazing people who I know who are sitting in this room right now, whether it's from their Torah knowledge or their chesed or their selflessness. And no matter what we're going to do when we introspect about a topic like this, it shouldn't in any way diminish the appreciation that we have for ourselves, for our community. It's got to be in the proper balance. But I do think, to talk about this topic, the topic of navigating change in my life, is something that is valuable to talk about collectively. You know, we're not talking about anybody specifically, we're talking about it in general, and I can reflect on it for myself, and everybody can think about it where they come from. So I want to begin with the challenge, or the interesting phenomenon, that if you turn to page 2, you will find a bit of research. Research that began in May of 2007 by Yeshiva University's Azraeli Graduate School of Administration, of Education and Administration. I'm getting the flag from the back that says, and it's not out of my covet, I guess it's for the person next to you, if you happen to have a cell phone that's on one of those cool newfangled rings, it's the 9 days starting tomorrow, so please just turn it off now. You can put it on silent. There's nothing in the 3 weeks about having a silent buzz in your pocket. Although I do know that in speaking to this audience, you know, not everybody has pockets, which is a whole other challenge, which I don't have, Baruch Hashem, but my phone is on It's on silent. Anyway, in May of 2007, Azrieli underwent a study of several hundred kids, both boys and girls, who were going to Israel, studying them and their parents while they were in Israel and after they came back from Israel. And they were studying the effects of change on these kids and on their parents and on their families based on their experience of their year in Israel. And they had a lot of interesting findings, which we're not going to explore directly today. But I thank Dr. David Pelkovitz, and we're going to mention many people, because many people who have helped me in thinking about this presentation, and Dr. Pelkovitz shared with me some of these research and some of his findings in working on this. So there were many areas that kids experienced growth and change when they studied in Israel, both boys and girls, and they looked at different aspects and how this affected them and their families. So there were certain behaviors that in certain cases changed and had different responses from parents. So what you're looking at here are some slides that they shared afterwards of student responses regarding how, parent responses regarding how their students changed in various different areas. So there's, on the left-hand side, there's changes in observance of Shabbos and Kashrus and others. On the right-hand side, there are what they call Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, so interactions with the opposite gender, touching relatives, family vacations. And they kind of looked at the different ways that parents responded to these changes, whether the parents were supportive, whether they were neutral, or they disputed them, and this caused friction in the home. So this topic is one that has, I suspect, been not necessarily this study, but this topic of my kids went to Israel and they came back and just fill in the rest of the Shabbos table. Like this, you don't know what happened to my kid, and then the other person says, well, that's nothing compared to what happened in, you know, my next door neighbor's kid, or I saw them in shul, or he was and she was, and it's like a whole. And we have to ask ourselves, why is this conversation happening? Why is it that there is a percentage of the parents who are in opposition? And more than that, why is it a thing? Why is it a conversation? Why is it a challenge and a struggle? So this is part of a bigger question about how we relate to changes in people's religious lives, both externally, let's say if it's our kids or our neighbors or our friends or our siblings, but also as it relates to ourselves. And it's very complicated and it's very sensitive. You're warm, Andrea? I thought it was only me. So we should find out.
It's just me.
Every year I stand here and I'm like, I have no jacket, I have no anything because I'm always so hot. And everybody's like, I'm so cold. All the women are so cold every year. That's the biggest complaint after the Arche Kala. So maybe it's just me. But if it's not just me, maybe this is Kraft. Maybe we should turn it down one drop before everyone falls asleep. Lo aleinu. So I'll turn your attention to the next page. It's not often in this year that we get a pitch for a movie, but this is a terrific movie, and I would encourage everybody to see it. I'm not going to tell you whether you should see it in the theater or at home or during the 9 days or after Shavuot Shechal, but whatever it is. But this is a movie called The Women's Balcony. Fantastic movie if you are of the ilk that has time for these kind of things. And there's a whole, we could have a whole other year about recreation in Halacha. So as part of this movie, the movie studies a group of Sephardic families in a shul in Yerushalayim. And it's a very fascinating reflection on Judaism, on us, on our families, on our halacha, on Rabbanim. It's a really, really thoughtful presentation. So as part of this presentation, as part of this movie, there was a rabbi who was in this Sephardic shul. I'm not going to give away too many spoilers except for one really, really great scene. So the rabbi comes into this Sephardic congregation. You have a couple of Sephardic men who are sitting there. You know, they have their yarmulkes on, a little trim beard. Maybe they're in their middle age, 50s and 60s, something like this. And they're all sitting around, and the rabbi gets up and gives a drasha. And it's fire and brimstone, it's passion, and it's so moving. And he describes how the wives of these men who are sitting there are so holy. They're Kodesh Kadashim, they're the holiest of the holy. They're like a Sefer Torah. Amish like a Sefer Torah. And just like a Sefer Torah has a mantle, has a covering, and there's modesty, and it's covered up. So too, of course, our wives should, of course, be just like Sefer Torah. They should have proper modesty. They should be covered. They should have proper dress and covering their hair. So all the men walk out of this drasha, and their mom is so inspired. They're so enthusiastic, so they go straight home, but they have a detour on the way. They go for a detour, and the scene shows each one of these, thank you very much, each one of these five husbands coming home, opening the door, and you can envision, for those who've been to Yerushalmi apartments, like that heavy door, you crank the door, you open it up, the husband walks in, and he says, "Ah, honey, I bought you a present. Ah, a present." So one of the wives is like, you know, because I'm not getting in the Shalom bias question of the present or the not present. So each one pulls out of their bag one of these. You ready? Okay, I never wore this. I'm just telling you, this is a mitpachat, they call it in Israel. So the woman opens the bag, she pulls this out. Spaze. Well, what is this? And the husband says, "You know, Harav Amar at mamash kamo sefer Torah. Your mamash like a sefer Torah." So she looks at him. She says, "Chaval shelo hevet li aron kodesh. Hayiti yoshev sham. I would sit in the aron kodesh if you brought it to me." And then the other woman, she doesn't pay too much attention. She goes, "Ah, say yafel purim," and she just puts it on the side. And all the men are like. So, and it becomes an issue because several of these women start to wear two of these, and several of them don't, and there's some tension, there's a question, and it just brings to the fore the issue and the question of, well, if I didn't do it until now, why should I start now? And is that me, and is it not me? So how do we navigate these kinds of changes? So I would say, before we think about this specific issue of change on a personal, practical level, we have to talk about the concept of change in general. I would say we could all agree that in certain areas of our religious life, there is an absolute, unquestionable need for change. For example, when our children or grandchildren, when they study, hopefully in a day school, they study Chumash and Rashi. So when a child studies Rashi in fourth grade or in fifth grade, so they understand the Rashi at the level of a fourth grader or a fifth grader, would we expect that a woman or a man who is now 44 would study the same Rashi with the same perspective as a fourth grader? Of course not. When it comes to study, when it comes to intellectual rigor and analysis, of course you expect change and you want change. And if we don't see change in the way that we learn, in the way that we think, in the way that we reflect, so then that's a problem. And it's not just true in terms of learning. It's also true, you could argue, in terms of character development. The Vilna Gaon, you know, the great genius of Vilna from the 18th century, has a very powerful statement. Pasuk in Mishlei here, in source number one, Pasuk tells us, "Hachzeik b'musar al teref, nitzrea ki hi chayecha." Hold on to musar, to character development, because that's your life. Says the Gra, "Ki hi chayecha." Why? "Ki masha adam chay," that which a person is alive, "Hu kedei lishbor mashalo shavar adheno oso hamida." It is to break the mida, the character trait they have yet to break. "Lachayin tzorech tamid l'hischazik v'im lo yischazik loma lo chayim." Why do I live if I'm not changing? We see children who are very young, young children, and what's one of the most difficult things for them to do is to share. So of course we expect small children to change and to grow when it comes to midos. And by the way, that challenge when it comes to character development and sharing is not restricted to preschoolers. As we go through life, we need to grow, we need to develop, because sometimes we have certain bad habits and we need to constantly, as the Vilna Gaon says, we need to constantly be aware of and conquering those bad habits. If we stay with the same habits that we had when we were adolescents, we would have lama lo chayim. We would have an unredeemed life. So I would say it's obvious to us that in these and other areas, we want to change. Everybody, if we took a survey, everybody would say, of course I want to change. I want to become more astute in my observations of learning. And of course I want to become more refined in my character. But then there are areas in which, you could argue, we don't want to change. There was a great Gaon. He was born in Europe, in a small, in a city called Bialystok. He was known, he moved to Warsaw for a period. He was an Avbezdin in Lomża, which is a very prominent Polish town. And his name was Rav Chaim Heller. Chaim Heller was a great gaon. He actually spent some time in Berlin and had a small yeshiva there before the Nazis came. He escaped to America, where he gave many shiurim in different places, including writing several svarim and a very important critical edition of the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvos. Rav Chaim Heller gave shiurim in different places in New York, and one of those places was at Ritz, at Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan at YU. And when the gaon Rav Chaim Heller died, none other than Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik delivered a eulogy in his memory. Let's just say not too many people in their career were eulogized by Rav Soloveitchik. And Rav Soloveitchik has an incredibly beautiful eulogy, tribute to the late gaon Rav Chaim Heller. And in there, he has one small observation, which is here in source number 3. He talks about the difference between an adult and a child. He says, "Ein chavayat Elokim mitzuya b'ba'alei pragmatia." The experience of God is not found in people who are practical. Rak hayeled, only the child. The picture of Rav Soloveitchik is on the left, and Rav Chaim Heller is on the bottom of the right. Rak hayeled mavkia es kol hagvulos v'hameitzarim. Only the child can break through the barriers of the reality, hamavdilim es hasofius min ha'einsof, that stand between the limited world in which we live and the einsof, the unlimited godliness. Only a child has that imagination. Only the child, third line, with his simple faith and his fantastic imagination, he can create this leap from this world into, so to speak, the lap of God. Says Rav Soloveitchik, he says, my grandfather, Rav Chaim Halevi. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was perhaps one of the greatest Talmudists of the last half millennia. He was a transformational Torah giant. But says Rav Soloveitchik, he says, that was just in the world of Talmud. But when it comes to Emuna, he says, my grandfather, Rav Chaim, was like a little kid. He had the Emuna Pshuta, the simple faith and the imagination of a child. So we don't want that to change. We want to be rooted to not a childish, but a childlike faith. And we want to be rooted to our parents and our family and where we come from. And I think that this is described, perhaps, Al-Pidrush on the next page, on page 4, in source number 4, in a beautiful illustration, incredibly beautiful illustration. We are at the end of the first book of Shmuel, and unfortunately Shaul's life, the king Saul, his life is unraveling. And tomorrow he's going to meet an untimely demise at the hands of the Plishtim. So tonight he goes to a woman, a sorceress, a Balas Ov, to conjure up the spirit of the late Shmuel Hanavi, the prophet Samuel. And the woman, the Balas Ov, doesn't know that he's the king Saul, so she brings up this soul of Shmuel HaNavi to this world from the depths of the other world. And the pasuk says, Vayomer la mata aro. What does he look like? Vatomer ish zakein olev v'hu otem me'il. He is an old man and he's wearing a jacket, a shawl. Vayeda shawl ki Shmuel hu vayikor apayim arza vayishtachu. And Shaul knew that was Shmuel. That was Samuel. He recognized him from the description. And my question is how? How did Shaul recognize from this description that he was an old man wearing a shawl? Oh, that's Shmuel. How did he know? Says Rashi, you know how he knew right there. V'ote me'il shahaya rogel lilbosh me'il. That Shmuel used to wear a shawl. What shawl? As it says in the next pasuk in source 5, way back at the beginning. U'me'il katan Taselo imo vaha alasolo miyamim yamima ba'alosa esishah lizboach ezevachayamim. His mother Chana, when he was a little boy, when he went to serve in the temple, his mother Chana made him a shawl. She sat at home, she knitted it for him, she brought it to him. So every year, as he got bigger, she brought him a new shawl. So Shaul looks at this description. Here's the description of a man in a shawl, and he says, that must be Shmuel. Could you imagine? Shmuel died when he was 52 years old, and he was the greatest prophet of his generation and probably for many generations. How did everybody know him? How was he recognized? Because he wore the same sweatshirt that his mom made for him when he was 5 years old. Every year she made him the same sweatshirt. So of course, when he comes back from the other world, he's wearing the same sweatshirt that his mama made for him. Can you imagine he's the Godel Hador and he's wearing the same sweatshirt from his first grade Chumash play? It's just a little bigger. So what's the message of this shawl? The message is that Shmuel never forgot that his mother was Chana, and it was his mother's prayers that brought him into this world, and that was what sustained him, and that's where he came from, and that would accompany him all the way until the other world, the Netzach Nitzachim. It's the shawl of Chana that he wore with him to the other world. He didn't say, well, you know, Ma, I love you. I love your knitting, but now I need a frock, man. I need a hat. I'm not going to wear a shawl. No. He went to face the Borei Olam in the next world with the shawl that his mother made for him. So we need to be connected. We need to maintain that which our parents gave to us. And this is binding in a halachic way, which is very powerful. The Gemara tells us in Pesachim, the bottom of number 6, B'nei Beishan nog delohava azlan mitzur letzidon b'male shabsa. The people of Beishan, they had a practice. They didn't travel on Friday from Tzur to Tzidon, from one city to the other city, because, you know, they might get waylaid. My grandmother should have her foolish shalem in Cleveland. If she knew this Gemara, she would say, Amen! I don't want to see you whenever you go to Cleveland on Friday. It's already a thing. You don't want to travel on Friday. That's what they did. Asu b'nayu kamed Rabbi Yochanan. The children of the B'nai Beishan came to Rabbi Yochanan. Amrulo, they said to him, Avasin efshalahu. Our parents, they didn't have so many needs. You know, we have kids in school, and we have business needs. So, do you mind? I think we just want to discuss with the Rav, can we travel on Friday, even though our parents did not? And we can't. Omar Luhu, Rabbi Yochanan said to them, Kvar kiblu avoseichem aleim. Your fathers already accepted it on them. Shenemar shma benimu saravicha v'yaltitosh Torah simecha. You may not fly on Friday. I don't care if it's Spirit or American or United. You may not. Because your parents didn't do it, so you can't do it either. It's minig avoseinu v'yadeinu. It's the practice of our forebearers. And this has expression in other areas of halacha with a different element. If you look on page 7, there was a great gaon in Hungary, in Munkács. The Munkács Rav, the Heilige Reb Tzvi Hirsch Shapira, the Hirsch Melech Shapira of Munkács, the top of page 5 in source 7. Page 5, source 7. The Darkei Tshuva is his classic commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. Reb Hirsch Melech Shapira was born in 1850 and he died in 1913. The great Munkacher dynasty with an incredible commentary on Yoredeya. The topic of this is beyond the scope of our discussion this morning, but it's discussing the question of the kashrus of Turkey. Because if you were living in the 19th century, there was a huge debate about Turkey. And it was not about the white meat versus the dark meat, and it wasn't about Thanksgiving or not Thanksgiving. It was about whether or not turkey is kosher. Because there was a big discussion in halacha about how to identify kosher birds. What qualifies as a kosher bird? Because when you open the Chumash, it does not tell you which birds are kosher. It only tells you which birds are not kosher. So there's a discussion. Do you need a tradition about which birds are kosher? So then there becomes a question further. Well, now we met turkeys. Where did they come from? Who ate them before? Do we have a Masorah about turkey? So by the way, there are still people today, Orthodox traditional people, who do not eat turkey because they follow the opinion of the Poskim that that's not acceptable. Says the Heilige Darkei Tshuva, I'm going to quote you from a Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Huda Berlin, the great Rosh Hashiva of Elozhin in the 19th century. The Netziv says about the top line, in the Meshiv Davar, Shenishal second line, Bedvar ha'avazos, avazes, a goose, ha'gidolim mishunim, these strange looking geese, these strange looking birds, about eating them or not eating them. He says, go to the middle and underline, benidon ze, in this case, kevan shekvar ochlim, we already eat it, b'makom hazeh, in this place, mikvar, b'cheskas kashrus, we assume that these birds, these turkeys are kosher. Unless you can prove otherwise, you should not be stringent. And further, he says, go to the next line, underline. If we say today, oh, we're not going to eat that bird, we're not going to eat it. Well, what about our forefathers who came before us? Are you telling us that they ate treif? So unless you have a proof that this turkey is not kosher, the people who had the practice of eating it and their parents ate it, you'll let them eat it. And this is part of a bigger observation, which is that we have to understand that different mesoros are proper, different traditions are proper, and different expressions of Judaism are proper. That is by design. Some of you are familiar that in the Chabad, their Seder is slightly different than in your regular, let's say, Sfard shul. I grew up in a shtibel, we daven Nusach Sfard. Nusach Sfard is not the same as what they daven in Chabad. They daven Nusach Ari. So Nusach Ari is a Nusach that the Seder was established by the late Gaon, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the founding Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he follows what's called Nusach Ari. So there was an early commentary on the Nusach Ari Seder called the Shar HaKolol by Rav Avram David Lavut, who is an early Chabad Chassid about 200 years ago, who wrote a commentary on the Seder, and he wrote a sefer called the Shar HaKolol explaining it. And this is on page 8. We don't have the time to see it inside. He says, I'll tell you something about this Chabad Seder. Everybody should use it. Great pitch. Why should everybody use it? He says, well, we all know that there are 12 tribes. And we all know that there are 12 different gates of Yerushalayim, and then there's a 13th. We all know that there are 13 places where people bowed in the Beis HaMikdash. Why are there 12 and then one more? He says, well, there are 12 tribes because there are 12 paths to Hashem Yisbarach, to God. Every shevet, every tribe had its own path. And then there were miscellaneous Jews. Let's say you didn't know what tribe you belonged to, or you were a convert. So there's the Shar HaKolel, the collective gate of Yerushalayim, the collective place to bow, where everybody belongs. So says, he quotes in the Mizritcher Magid, he says, you know, there were 12 different Sidurim. Shevet Reuven had a Siddur, and Shevet Gad had a Siddur. They had a different way of praying. They had a different way of davening, a different way of connecting to the Rabbona Shel Olam. Well, if you don't know what tribe you are, you should daven the 13th kind of catch-all Siddur. You know what that is? That's the Nusach Ari. So the Arizal was misakein that this is the Nusach HaKolel. Everybody, if you don't know what tribe you're from, you should daven Nusach Ari. That's his pitch. But what he's telling us is that we each need to know that we're not going to be the same as the next person. And it's by design that the people in Shevet Yisachar have a process and a path in Avodas Hashem that is distinct from the people in Shevet Zevulun, and that is intentional. So if you look at somebody else's family and say, wow, their Avodas Hashem is different than mine, that's not surprising. That's intentional. So now, we bring all this back, and we're like, okay, so on the one hand, there are certain areas where we know we need to grow, we know we need to change over time, and then there are certain areas that we don't. And so we zero in on these specific practices that we see in others, and then things that we think about for ourselves, and I wonder to myself, well, should I be taking that on? Should I be doing that? And then it gets a little bit touchy. One of the people who I consulted with who gave a tremendous amount of insight into this presentation is my teacher, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter. So Rabbi Schachter told me, he said it's permitted, it's okay to share the story, that when he became the rabbi of the Jewish Center in Manhattan in 1982, there were some things that he thought needed clarification about the practices in the shul that he wasn't so comfortable with. And he went to ask Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. So one of the things that was an issue in the shul that he was uncertain about was the mechitza at that time in the Jewish center. So he tried to describe to the Rav the structure of the mechitza and the height of the mechitza and how the shul, the seating went like this and it went like that. So he says, on that issue, Rav Soloveitchik said to him, if it was scandalous, I would have heard about it. No problem. That's what the Rav told him. No problem. No problem. But then Rabbi Schachter said to him, he said, you know, in this shul, they daven Mincha Maariv at 6:30 in the afternoon. 6:30 in the afternoon in the summertime in New York City means that Maariv is going to be so early, it's before even Plag HaMincha. In the hour and a quarter, you know, it's more complicated than his time to address right now the halachic specifications of the time. But I'm not aware of any synagogue in the world that davens Maariv, the evening prayer, in the afternoon when it's light outside before Plag HaMincha. Nobody would light, you know, would think to accept Shabbos before Plag HaMincha light Shabbos candles. So Rav Soloveitchik said to him, you'll change it. So the next week, Rabbi Schachter, with his tshuvas from the Rav, goes to meet with the president of the shul. He said it was a very fine fellow. He did not tell me his name. And don't go Googling it. So he said, you know, these are the few things that we want to think about as I'm becoming the rabbi of the shul. And one of them is the zmanim, the time. If we move it to 7 o'clock in the summertime, then 98% of the weeks it won't be a problem. He says, excuse me, Rabbi, what are you saying? This wasn't good enough for Rabbi Lamb. This wasn't good enough for the late Rabbi, well, at that time I think he was still living, Rabbi Jung. Are you trying to move our synagogue to the right, Rabbi? Because you know that's not what we're about. He then proceeded at Shalashuddis to get up and extemporaneously speak to the congregation, did the president, warning them of this impending move to the right by this new young rabbi, PhD from Harvard, just saying, who's taking the congregation to the right with this big change, moving their Mincha Maariv in the summertime from 6:30 to 7 o'clock so that they could accommodate this question of Plag HaMincha for Maariv. A year later, they did move it. I don't know what happened to that president. I'm not speaking about shul presidents. I'm just saying, but what about us? When we face these questions, do we say, ah, they're trying to move us to the right again, or my kid is moving to the right, or my grandmother's moving to the right, or, you know, that's not for me. We don't do that. So how do we decide? How do we navigate this question of change? So perhaps we can look at two factors to determine whether or not we should take upon ourselves a change. We'll call them merit and motivation. The first question is the question of merit. Let's look at my current practice, how I am right now. So depending on the merit of my current practice, that's going to determine whether I should throw it out the window or not. I'll tell you a story. We have in this community a great blessing of a tremendous Talmud Chacham. His name is Rabbi Daniel Raka. So Rabbi Raka, I believe he is Tunisian. He is the Sephardic Rav, and he is Tunisian. And you have to get this right, because I spoke to him once about the different, you know, for a Galicianer, Tunisian and Iraq. Neither of them eat cholent, so it's not so significant. But apparently in that world, you got to watch out if you're Moroccan or Syrian or whatever. So Rabbi Raka said that in certain communities, and I don't remember if he even said this was the case in his own house, at the Shabbos table, after the father would cut the challah, he would throw the piece of challah to the people at the table. Which is kind of strange, because it's clear in halacha that you're not allowed to throw bread. So Rabbi Raka told me, he said, yeah, but I was looking in this Sephardi posik from Tunisia, from Mechvei, some sefer, such and such, he's a student of Rabbi Vadia, and he has a tremendous knowledge. He says, you know, it says in this sefer that your table is like a mizbeach. And you know that in the Beis HaMikdash, the mizbeach had a ramp that would lead up to it, and then it had the altar on the top, and there was a little tiny space of air that was necessary, the Gemara says in Zvachim, between the ramp and the mizbeach itself. They had to have a space. I don't know if you ever looked that carefully in the diagrams, but there was a space. Why? Because when you put the limbs, the fats, depending on what you're offering, ola or chatas, whatever it is, when you put it on the fire, on the eish, you have to throw it. You can't put it. So they have a little airspace, so that would be a din of zrika. You're throwing it over the space that exists between the kevesh, the ramp, and the mizbeach. So Rabbi Raka said, you know what it says in the Sefer? It says that since your table is like a mizbeach, when you first cut the challah, it's like putting the limbs or the fats of the animal on the altar, and you have to throw it. So even though during the week when you eat a sandwich, of course you're not allowed to throw bread, but in Tunisia, they would bedafka throw the first piece of challah and to whoever, you know, the people at the table, to be mekayim that it's just like the mizbeach in the Beis HaMikdash. So before you start changing your minhagim, You should be very careful to speak to Rabbi Raka, who knows about Minhagim, or some other Talmud Chacham to figure out whether or not your Minhag is a correct Minhag. At the same time, we know there's something called a Minhag Kosher, a proper Minhag, and then there's something called a Minhag Tos, a mistaken Minhag. There's nowhere in Halacha that has, you know, it's our family Minhag that we eat non-kosher cheese out of the house. That's not a Minhag. That's just not. It's just not. So then there is a big discussion in Hilchas Purim, in the Magen Avraham, and in later, we don't have time for it today, about how do you balance the weight of Minhag versus other aspects of Halacha. And you can see there is a beautiful tshuva in the tshuvas of, it's not in the packet, in the Aselach HaRav of Rav Chaim David HaLevi, the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, where he says that in general, if your Minhag is in violation of any Halacha, you got to have the Minhag stand aside. Unless it's in the area of mamonos or other very limited circumstances. So the first thing is you have to figure out what's the merit of my current practice. And then I have to figure out what's the merit of my new practice. Is this new practice, is it a din? Is it a law? Is it a law from the Pasuk in the Chumash? Is it a law from the Gemara? Is it a Takanas Chazal? Is it a Rambam? Is it in the Shulchan Aruch? Or is it a Chumrah? And based on that, you want to think about the relative importance of that. Sometimes those are dangerous. The Gemara says in the bottom of page 9, the Gemara tells a story about one of the Amoraim, Hava Messiah Messani Uchmi, was wearing black shoes, Vikoy Beshuka Din Harda. And source number 9 on the bottom of page 5. Source 9. Says the Gemara, this Amor was walking with black shoes. So he was walking the Reish Galusa, the exilarch saw him. He said, Maishna Hani Masani, where you want? Why are you wearing black shoes? He says, oh, you know why? Because I'm being Mis'abel, I'm mourning for Yerushalayim. So everybody else wears white shoes, but I'm so broken, I'm so tzibrochen about the Beis HaMikdash being destroyed, I have to show my sign of mourning all the time, so I wear black shoes. So the Gemara says, Savor, you are Ahava. They thought that it was just arrogance, hubris. You have to be careful about this. Rav Shechter likes, my Rebbe, Rav Herschel Shechter Shlita, likes to tell a story, a joke, a Yiddish joke, that a student once came to his Rebbe and he said, Rebbe, I have a shaila for you, because in the world of Halacha, there's something called mechzi. It looks like. It appears like. He said, Rebbe, I have a shaila. I wanted to take on such and such a practice, he says to his Rebbe. I want to take this on, but I wanted to know, what do you think? Do you think it's mechzi kiyura? Does it look like arrogance? So the Rebbe said, no, it's not mechzi kiyura. It doesn't look like arrogance. It's yura mamish. It's real arrogance. It's totally inappropriate for you to take on that chumrah. Who are you to take on that chumrah? Rav Shechter tells a story when Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha, when he passed away, there was a big Talmud Chacham, Rav Nissen Alpert, Zechron Livracha. Rav Nissen Alpert gave a hesped for Rav Moshe, and he says, you know that in the Chumash there is a psul for a Kohen who is, God forbid, what's called a sarua. He has one arm or one leg, God forbid, that's longer than the other long one, Rahman al-Islam. His extremities are out of balance. Let's say he has one eye, God forbid, than the other. So it's a mum, it's a blemish for that Kohen, for that that person or that animal. It's unbalanced. So Rav Nissen Alper said, you know, Rav Moshe was so balanced that he was an expert in Orachaim and daily living as much as he was an expert in Kachim, in the rules of the Beis HaMikdash, as much as he was an expert in Taurus. Everything was in balance. So Shechter used to tell us, that's the way it has to be in Halacha. If a person has tremendous chumras in one area, so that has to be balanced. He has to have chumras all over the place. You can imagine somebody who violates half the dinim on this side, and then he has a few peculiar, particular chumras that are not the letter of the law at all. Shechter says, that's a sarua, that's totally unbalanced. So a person's merits, in terms of thinking about the new practice, it has to be balanced. It has to be a din, and if it's a chumrah, it has to be in balance. So there's merit. And the other question is a question of motivation. Why is the person interested in taking this on? Is the person interested in taking this on just because they want to fit in with the crowd? Are they taking it on because they want to just use it as an expression of their independence? Well, that could be, in many ways, has nothing to do with religion. It's not a halachic imperative. Or are they taking it on because it's an expression of their closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So if it fits these criteria, if it is a din, or if it's an appropriate chumrah, and it's being motivated correctly, so then, should we take it on? So I would say we should. And I'll give you two examples of why we should. Imagine you take somebody, who runs a business. They run their business, and you come into their office, and you say, let's say they're a travel agent. Or not a travel agent, or somebody, take anybody in this room. You want to book a ticket. Somebody comes into you and say, can you book me a ticket? It's a good time to acknowledge the presence of my mother-in-law. Welcome and thank you for coming. It's an honor. So would anybody say, I'm going to call the airline and have them mail me a ticket today? Because in the 50s, that's what we did. We called the airline and they would mail it to us. And I would walk down to the terminal and just, show up 5 minutes before because I could just get on the plane. You remember those days, right? I don't. I remember pre-security, but would anybody say, I'm going to run my business like we did in the 50s? In the 50s, we had everything in a Rolodex, and we billed everybody. We had, somebody who did the billing on a typewriter, like my grandmother. She had a typewriter. She did the books, and my grandfather, Zichron Levrach, in his business. So they're going to mail out invoices the same way they did on a typewriter. We're not going to email invoices, because in the 50s, we didn't email anybody. Nobody runs their business today like they did in the 50s. So it's not an argument to say, in the 50s was a different time and it was a different place. Somebody would say, in the 50s we had this and we did that. You wouldn't run your business like you did in the 50s. You're not going to run your yadus like you did in the 50s. And the other thing is that when it comes to comparing and contrasting, the world today is not what it was in the 50s. When you watch the mixed dancing in the streets, the Hava Nagila in 1948 outside, in Tel Aviv, that is not the same dancing, not that I've ever experienced this, but shamati me'achori hapargo, that's what's going on with chves, various forms of dancing that involves young people today. It's not, the black and white going back and forth like this. You know what I'm saying? It's not the same. It's true for business, and it's also true for relationships. And now I can acknowledge the presence of my dear wife, without whom I would certainly not be here. Relationships are like that. Does a person have the same relationship with their close friend that they did when they first met 25 years ago? Or if it's a spouse, do we expect that we're going to have the same level of relationship, the same card, the same happy anniversary card, the same birthday card? It's going to say exactly the same thing. It will not have developed in any way since the first time we met. If that's the case, it's pretty sad. So if our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if our relationship with God is a relationship, then of course it has to develop. You don't say, now I have $100,000 in the bank and it's our 50th wedding anniversary. But you know what? When we got married on our first anniversary, I bought you a half a dozen roses. So I'm going to buy you a half a dozen roses from, we went to ShopRite. So I'll go back to ShopRite, back in New Jersey, and I'll buy you a half a dozen roses. You have $1 million in the bank. You could buy me a dozen roses. So nobody would say that you want your relationship with another person to stay at the same stagnant place since it was in the 1950s. Of course our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to stay at the same place where it was in the 1950s. So here's the challenge, and I'd like to close with this. It'll take us a few minutes, but I want to identify one major challenge. Because now at this point we're thinking, okay, why not? If we have a good practice that's meritorious and it fits, and I'm not going to speak about whatever practice again. Everybody thinks about what's pertinent to them, and I certainly can think of a whole list of things that I should probably be doing. So what's the impediment? Why am I not doing it? Why am I not changing? So the answer is, there are many reasons. There are a lot of reasons. Change is one of the most difficult things to do on a lot of levels. The people in marketing know that the best. Change is difficult. But I think there's one specific aspect of change that makes it really difficult for us on a religious level, and it's the Rambam. The Rambam gets in our way on the top of the next page, on page 6, in source number 10. The Rambam, he has good intentions over here. The Rambam tells you, How amazing is a Baal Tshuva? Source number 10. Says the Halakha Rambam in Perek Zion. He says, G'dola tshuva shemekareves es ha'adam l'shechina. Tshuva is so great that it brings a person closer to the Shechina. And not only that, the Rambam says in the bold letters, he says, I'm going to spell it out for you. Emesh, yesterday, hayazeh sonrei lefnei hamakom, this person was hated by God, meshukatz umeruchak v'toeva. He was disgusting and distant and abomination. V'hayom! And today, the Baal Tshuva, who ahu v'nechmad karov yedid, he is beloved, he's close, he's a friend, and he's connected to God. Amazing. This Rambam is great for an annual Tshuva Drasha. It's great for a rabbi on Yom Kippur. It's great for us to read, you know, after Maftar Yonah. It's an amazing. Look at the power of Tshuva. But look what it also says. It says, wait a second. Yesterday, that means I wasn't that. When I see that other person becoming a Baal Tshuva, growing, developing, taking on new aspects in their religious life, what does that say about me? That person is doing that, so you know what that says? I'm a shegetz, as it's saying in Yiddish. I'm a nothing. I'm still in the first half of this Rambam. I don't want to be a shegetz. So I get very uncomfortable when I'm sitting next to the Baal Tshuva who's davening with Kavan. I'm like, ah, there's just a Baal Tshuva. You know, I don't know if anybody here ever met a Baal Tshuva, but sometimes you have Baal Tshuva, people who come back to Judaism, and they're amazingly inspired. So somebody sitting next to them is like, you don't want to sit next to Baal Tshuva because you don't want to be inspired, for sure. Like, that's horrible. Why? Because it makes us feel bad about ourselves, because we say then, we're Meshukatz Merucha V'Toeva. And what about if it's within myself? You say, well, if I take on that practice, you know what's going to happen every time I look in the mirror? I'm going to remind myself that last week, I was mamash goy, yeah? I was a nothing. I was meshukatz. So this is where the tension is. I'm not going to take something on, or when somebody else takes something on, it's challenging my identity. It's taking away the value that I have in myself. I'm now invalidating my entire life. The Rambam says I'm a shegetz if I take something on, because it tells me that I was a shegetz yesterday. So perhaps there is another way to look at this in addition to this Rambam, and I'll share with you two stories. For purposes of time, we're not going to see it inside. The Gemara in Maseches Menachos in source number 11, it's an incredible story about an unlikely hero. The English is on page 7, the Aramaic is on page 6. The Gemara here tells the story of a prostitute. A very exclusive and expensive woman. The Gemara says that her fee was 400 zehuvim. And there was a guy who lived in a faraway land who heard about this woman, and he says, this is for me. So he travels all the way to find this woman. And the Gemara describes that she sets out 7 beds, 6 of silver and 1 of gold. And she's sitting there unclothed, waiting for him at the 7th one. And as he is climbing up, unclothed, he's taking off his clothing, the Gemara says his tzitzis hit him in the head. And he gets hit by the tzitzis and he climbs down, he sits on the floor. And a woman runs down after him and she sits down next to him and she says, I will not let you leave until you tell me, what did you see in me that was you know, a mum, a blemish, the Gemara says, that was unappealing. He says, I have to tell you, I didn't see anything in you that was unappealing. But I just got hit with the tzitzis. And you should know that God gave us this one mitzvah of tzitzis. And it says that Ani Hashem Elokeichem 2 times. I am Hashem, your God, who will compensate you for what you did right and who will punish you for what you did wrong. And here I am, I'm telling you, you're the most beautiful woman I ever saw, but I can't do this. So she says, I won't let you go until you tell me, Ma Shmeich, what is your name? Where are you from? Ma Shem Ircha? Uma Shem Rabcha? Uma Shem Midrashcha? Apparently she knew he learned in a yeshiva. So now, this young man, he leaves the scene. Who takes the focus of the story? This woman. So the Gemara says she picks up her stuff, and she says, I'm going to go. Omda vechilka kol nechaseh shlish lamalcha shlish la'aniyim shlish natla biyada. She divides her assets into thirds. One third she gives up to the government, taxes. Another third she gives to the poor people. A third she takes with herself. And she travels all the way to this identified address. She has the piece of paper. She comes to the Beis HaMedrash. And she finds Reb Chiya, one of the great sages, earliest sages of the Talmud. Later the Mishnah, earlier the Talmud. And he says to her, "Why are you here?" She says, "I'm looking for this boy." He says, "Oh, you're looking for this boy? You know, are you just interested in checking out the boys?" She says, "Here's the piece of paper. This is my story." Reb Chiya says, "Wow, what do you have with you?" She says, "You know what I brought? I brought the matzos. I brought the bedding that I had. I brought it with me for my new home. I have one third of my possessions and the clothing and the sheets from my bed and my blankets." Says Reb Chiya, "Go find this boy, and those blankets that you used for your old life, Hashem should bless you, you should enjoy it in your new life." And the Gemara goes on to say, this is the schar of the mitzvah of tzitzis. Amazing. It's an incredible story, and it needs to be unpacked for several hours, and we only have several moments. But what's interesting is that the Gemara describes in the middle that this woman was not Jewish, and she converts. So the Maharal says, what's going on over here? Why did she have to sell two-thirds of her property? The Maharal says, because you know why? When she converted, she gave up most of her previous identity. So she sold off two-thirds of her assets. But one-third of who she was, that she took with her. Even though the Gemara says that a convert, Gershon is Gair Kakotin Shinola Dummy, it's like a new person, Maharal says, not totally new. So much so that the same sheets from her bed that she used from her former life, and who knows who was using those and what she was doing over there, we know what that was. Reb Chiya says, now you should use them in good health with your husband, you should live a life of Kedusha. Wait a second. Doesn't that serve as a reminder to her old life? Emes, she was this or that. You see from this Gemara that the Chazal do not look at this convert and say you have to throw away your old life. You have to filter it. You have to leave the bulk of it behind as a convert, but you have to take some of it with you because that's part of your identity. That's part of who you are. And you can use it latov. And there's a similar description, if you look on the next page, that when we become, it's not just when we convert, it's when we become a Baal Tshuva, we don't erase or ignore our past. We don't need to invalidate everything that we were before. Just because we change, it doesn't mean we are throwing it all away. I might argue that instead of thinking about our religious growth in terms of change, I wouldn't say we change, I would say we develop. Because change is saying, we're going to flip out. That's a term. Flipping out. My kids are flipping out. My grandchildren, my neighbors, they're flipping out. Flipping out is when you were one thing and then you become something else. We're not looking to flip out. We're looking to develop who we really are. To take that part of our past and develop it. So Reish Lakish says an amazing thing in the Gemara in Yuvah Peivav Amud Beis. He says, you know how great tshuva is? It takes the averos, the sins that we did, the mistakes that we made, that were bemazed, intentional, and transform them into merits when we recreate ourselves, when we develop. Because we're going to take that into our new identity. And how did Reish Lakish know this? Because he was a Baal Tshuva. The Gemara says, and we don't have time to develop this at length, if you're interested, take a look. There is a journal, it's not published anymore, but there is a scholarly journal published by the Shalem Institute called Azure. And in 2008, Ido Chevroni wrote an article called A Tale of Two Sinners on page 8, where Reb Yochanan, who was one of the good, best-looking men in the Talmud on page 8, was swimming in the river, and Reish Lakish, who was a bandit, who was the leader of the gangster storm and started swimming after him. So Reb Yochanan said to him, Reish Lakish said, your looks should be for women. And Reb Yochanan said to him, your strength should be for Torah. So the Gemara describes how he became a Baal Tshuva and he studied with Reb Yochanan. And at one point there was a shaila in the Beis Medrash about the status of a dagger and when it becomes ritually impure or not. And Reb Yochanan says to him, this is my opinion. Reish Lakish responds with my opinion. And Rabbi Yochanan says, you know daggers because you were a gangster. And Reish Lakish says, you know what? And Rashi and Tosfos have a debate about this. What he answers, he says, you know what? They gave me cover when I was there and they helped me. What did you help me, Rabbi Yochanan? Rabbi Yochanan says, well, I helped you because I brought you closer to God. And they have a back and forth. Take a look in the Maharsha there. It's not a simple story. It's very complicated. But Rabbi Yochanan was insulted by this exchange, and because of that, because of his spiritual greatness, this titan of the Talmud, Reish Lakish became ill. Ultimately, Reish Lakish passes away. So Rabbi Elazar ben Pedas, one of the other students, comes to Rabbi Yochanan, and he takes the place in the front of the shir. He's the first bachur now, first boy sitting in the shir. And when Rabbi Yochanan would say something, the Gemara says that Rabbi Yochanan would say something, and Rabbi Elazar would give him 12 proofs. Everything he would say, Tanya, no, he doesn't say 12 proofs, he would say, we give him a proof. The Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan was so aggravated. He says, I can't learn like this. When Reish Lakish was here, I would say something, and he would give me 12 questions. And you say, good job, yeah, I'll give you a proof. He says, I don't need that. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yochanan went out of his mind. He lost his sanity. And the rabbis davened that he should pass away, and he did. He died because he lost his chavrusa of Reish Lakish. So what's the pshat? Perhaps what's going on here is that Rabbi Yochanan, originally, he said, when you become a Baal Tshuva, you have to leave it all behind. You're not going to swim to the other side of the river, as the Gemara says, and this is just on one foot. But Reish Lakish says, no. I'm going to take my gangster lifestyle and I'm going to bring it into who I am and utilize it for my understanding of the Beis Medrash, and I'm going to take that sharpness to challenge you because my perspective is different than yours. You come from a world where it's one way, I come from a world where it's something else. And together, we can bring out the Divrei Elokim Chayim. And at the end of his life, Rabbi Yochanan says, you know what? I miss that other perspective. I miss that Baal Tshuva. I miss the person with that different perspective in their life. We'll conclude on the bottom of page 9 with an incredible passage from Rav Kook and a story. This is from a more recently published work called the Shmona Kvatzim of Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, whose picture you see from Yafo on the left. These Kvatzim are Rav Kook's handwritten notes, which is on picture for you, a Xerox copy on the bottom right. And if you want to see more about Rav Kook next time in Yerushalayim or HaKodesh, I would strongly encourage you to go to Beit HaRav, which is right here on Rehov HaRav Kook, the building you're looking at. They kept the original house and the original Beis Medrash. It's incredible. Rav Kook says the following. Kishaoskim b'tshuva, when we do tshuva, tzrichim lahagdir b'yoser es mohusem shel hatov v'hara. First we have to identify what is good and what is bad. Kidei shehacharata, so that the remorse, v'zazua, and the trembling, haratzon, mechiyuv l'shlila, yipol rak al hara v'lo al hatov. That we should regret and be struggling over only the bad parts of what we did, not the good parts. We shouldn't regret that. Va'od Yoser, says Rav Kook, Shetzarech levarer es hatov hanimtza ba'omek hara. You have to find the good, which is buried in the right in the bowels of the evil. Ulachazek oso, and to strengthen it. Ba'oso hakoach atzma, with its force itself, shaborchim in hara. With the same strength that we run away from that previous behavior, we use the same strength to find the goodness within it, the redeemed qualities of it, of that ra, of that place where we used to be, what we did before. Kedei shetia hatshuva koach poel letova, so that the tshuva will be a force for good. Hamahapeches mamish es kol hazedonos lezechuyos. That will transform the averos, the mistakes that were done on purpose, into mistakes that are now merits, to zechuyos, that are merits. How do you do that? How do you transform your mistakes into your merits? By going back to those mistakes and saying, you know what? I don't have to say that's not me anymore. I could say that was my past and there was something valuable in that. I'm not going to throw that away and I'm not going to be embarrassed of it. But I can also move forward. I can grow. There's a person in our community, I don't know if he wants to be named, Today is one of the elder statesmen who I've heard told this story a few times. Not too long ago, the late Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, was visiting Chicago, and he was staying with some people. So this gentleman in our community received a phone call in his office. And the secretary buzzed in and he said that there is a man on the phone for you and his name is Nady. So the gentleman thinks to himself, I only know one Nady. Picks up the phone and he says, hello, so-and-so. This is Nady Finkel. He says, excuse me, is this Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, Shalita, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva? He says, yes, it's me, Nady. He says, I'm here in Chicago and I'd like you to come over. I have my wife here and a couple of Talmidim. We're staying in such and such a house. I'd like you to come over so we can just share a little bit about the old days. Because those who know, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, Zichrono Levracha, was a student here in the Ida Crown Jewish Academy when it was on the southwest, east-west, wherever it was in those days. A mall in Chicago, we remember. You always have to put that in there somewhere. In the old west side. So it was the Chicago Jewish Academy, Chveis, when we're... All right. We're good. And on the basketball team. Great. So this gentleman says, do you want me to come over and talk about really like what it was like when we used to hang out when we were in the academy, which is a co-ed school, and we went to a certain camp, I think we went to Camp Moshava and other places. Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, Zichrono Levracha, says, yeah, I want to be able to talk about what it was like. Because that's part of what made me who I am today. So when we think about change in our own lives, and we think about navigating areas in which we need to change, areas in which we should not change, and the more complex question in the middle of when we think we probably should change, we're not sure, we're doing the research, we're doing the analysis, we're cheshbonning what are the side effects, the externalities, what does it mean for me, is it appropriate, am I ready for this? I think one thing that we should keep in mind is that we do not need to say, well, if I change now, that means that everybody else around me, they're an oisvarf. Or, more powerfully, that what I was yesterday was a shegetz. What that means is that I'm developing and growing in my relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And different people are at different places and at different points in their journey. And that when I look at my past, as I grow, I don't have to throw it away. I don't have to deny that previous part of my existence. When I look at it and say, look, I've come a long way in this area, but you know what? The fact that I did such and such, maybe it was an Issur D'oraisa, but there was some aspect of that, says Rav Kook, that is redeemed. There was some aspect, and it could be even mamish, the grossest, worst violations. But even in there, there is an itzotz of tov, says Rav Kook, that you can find and seek comfort in. And perhaps with some of these ideas, we can each grow in our avodas Hashem as we grow in our lives. I thank you all for listening and wish you a wonderful and terrific day.